Welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. Another great one in store for you today. Pro guide, dog trainer, giving us some practical advice on how to get the most out of our own pooches. Tracy Leeske joins me in just a few minutes. Looking forward to learning a hell of a lot from this guy. He's been in the business a long time, hunting wild birds in the, well, in the Great North, I'll call it that. More on him to come very soon, but plenty else to talk about as well. How your weekend went, why you hunt. We'll do a poll on how you support conservation. Our dog training segment will be a listener question and my answer on how many hours a dog can hunt in a day, so be curious to hear from you on that one as well. And then our public access segment, This Land Is Your Land, offer up a, well, I'm going to climb up on my soapbox a little bit, suggest a few things to you that might help in the long run and the short run, actually, for that matter. So a lot to talk about, starting with the weekend around here. The snow is gone, at least for now. And if you're in Texas, you have my sympathy, because even though the weather has probably lightened up, relatively speaking, you're still suffering in one or 101 ways. So good luck on that. A lot of questions over the last few days about how the weather in Texas is going to affect bird populations and the hunting business in general. Had a fascinating conversation with somebody about how bad weather in Texas means lots of dogs on the market from pro trainers and hunting guides down there that they can't use anymore for any number of reasons. So, you know, if you're wondering why there's a flood of great pointers on the market, it might be in part due to that. So, interesting stuff. Right here, dog training is in high gear, shooting some videos for my friends at Happy Jack on that topic. You'll be able to watch those very soon. And in the shooting arena, yes, I'm still working hard at getting 20-gauge target ammo so that my summer of 100 rounds per weekend all summer will take place. So if you know anybody or if you got any suggestions about how to find 20-gauge target ammo, man, I am open to that. It is tough to find. Your weekend? Well, we don't have any hunting to talk about, really. Well, with a few exceptions. So I'm asking on our Monday morning debrief about the things, the reasons we go hunting. And this week's question was regarding the third highest criterion on our list, according to my Upland Nation Index survey. And that is, we hunt to walk among beauty, be in beautiful places, love the places we are. And surprisingly, maybe not surprisingly, more comments on this topic than the first two. Keith Erickson, my new friend from Northern Nevada, says the day after speaking with you at the motel, here's a shot, and it is a beautiful one of a lightly snow-covered plateau in Northern Nevada, and hopefully, Keith, you'll be showing me that one next season. Christy Anderson, oh my, what a beautiful shot of some aspens in a lot of vegetation and two or three different colors of blooms, and I won't venture a guess as to say more than they're red-ish to these colorblind eyes. She says, early season grouse hunting is breathtaking. Yeah, I can't agree more. Glenn Ainsworth shows me a big, wide shot of a whole bunch of folds in the landscape with probably creek bottoms at the very bottom of each of those. This wasn't from last weekend, but from last season, he says. It proved to be a pretty good day. Well, aren't they all when the scenery looks like that? And Mike Harris reminds us that the upland season in Alaska goes through March. He's got a picture of his beautiful wire hair and the Chugach mountain range in the background. Looks like winter there, Mike. Brr. But you can see all the way to Kodiak, he says. Puddle ducks on the flats and sea ducks everywhere else. And several big game hunts on the agenda for him. Linda Syke says the Yucca Valley and some training going on and tracking as well this weekend. And Nick Spurlock finally got to take a young lady along who worked so hard to pass her hunter's safety, got her first license, and has very good taste in dogs. It looks like a short hair and a Labrador sitting with her. Good on all of you. So keep up the good work. Another great question for you coming up very soon. Every Monday morning at the Wing Shooting USA and the Upland Nation Facebook pages. So check in every once in a while, share your thoughts, and share your photos, because we love looking at them, especially as the season winds down and we got nowhere else to go for a thrill like that. All right, the Upland Nation podcast is brought to you in part by Sage and Breaker Gun Care Products, crafted at the highest caliber, always free shipping, gift cards. Get on the mailing list. You'll have your first shot at new gear before everybody else finds out about it. Go to sageandbreaker.com. And for slightly used brand name gear, go to uplandnationdeals.com. That's where you'll find the stuff that you really want that you maybe would rather pay less than full price for. About half price is what most of the stuff goes for there. It's all at uplandnationdeals.com. Yeah, so enough about that. Let's get on to the podcast here at the Upland Nation. Joining me from Mimo's Farm is where he's based these days for hunting and dog training. Tracy Liske joins me. Tracy, welcome to the Upland Nation podcast.
Well, thanks, Scott. I appreciate the invitation.
You know, you've been on my short list for quite a while, and I'm finally getting around to it, and I apologize. But, you know, you get recommended every once in a while from a Facebook post or a listener call or something like that. You've been around a bit. Tell me a little bit about yourself and where you've been and what you're doing these days.
Well, Scott, I'm at Mimo's Farm in northwestern Michigan. We're about 40 minutes away from Traverse City. They're on the gold western coast of Michigan. How I got there is I lived quite a vagabond lifestyle for quite a while. Started the training dogs when I was 12 and just continued on. Was really fortunate to work with some great dog trainers over the years. And the dogs have taken me to a lot of places that I probably never would have went to. Over the years, I've worked at 7 Orvis endorsed lodges throughout the country, as well as numerous private and other avenues in the wing shooting world. That's put lots of miles on my trucks.
That's one way to put it, and a lot of dogs in your string over the years, I'm sure.
Indeed.
You know, if you had to narrow it down to one place, and I'm looking at a part of your list, and I think I've been to about half the Orvis endorsed lodges you worked at, but we never crossed paths. Can you pick out one that you love the most out of all of those?
Well, they've all got their own special niche in Orvis lineup, I think. However, there is one that I do hold near and dear to my heart. I spent several seasons at the Flying Bee Ranch in Kamiai, Idaho.
Yeah, one of my favorites. In fact, the Small World, I've been there several times. And if you're looking it up on the map, everybody, it's not spelled like it sounds, but... It's a wonderful place, and had a lot of fun down there. Now, tell me, Tracy, you've got a lot of dogs. You've been around a while. If you had to narrow it down to a style, a breed, anything like that, could you do that?
You know, Scott, it seems like breeds have kind of fashioned off quite a bit over the last 30 or 40 years. You know, when somebody says they've got a short hair, they've got a setter that they want me to train, all kinds of things run through my mind of what kind of setter, what kind of short hair they've got.
Yeah.
And it's just that way in other breeds also. I like to look more at families within the breed. A good dog's a good dog. And because I don't do a lot of breeding, I'm not really breed blind, so to speak. Currently in my string, I've got 3 Rottweilers, 3 English Setters, and 1 Dynamo English Cocker Spaniel.
We're going to talk about that Cocker in a few minutes for sure. But, of course, I've got a soft spot in my heart for those bearded breeds. And looking at one now, he's sleeping, and hopefully he'll stay quiet for the rest of the podcast. But if you had to figure it out, and maybe you think about this every day, maybe you seldom think about it, but what is it about dogs and hunting that really gets you worked up? Why do you keep doing it, Tracy?
Well, I've always wanted to see what's over the next curve or at the end of the horizon. Following bird dogs makes you do that. And, you know, seeing a dog do what it was genetically programmed to do and do it well is kind of like watching a great athlete, whether it be baseball, football, basketball, or any other sport. It still takes my breath away when I see a dog catch scent and slam into that point. Or be it a flushing dog, really working hard and putting that bird up in the air for you.
I don't think you're going to get any arguments from our listeners over that one. That's exactly right. And you're making the hair stand up on the back of my neck just describing it that way. If you you do both. You guide hunts and you train dogs. Can you narrow it down to one or the other if you had to?
Whether I'd like to guide or train?
Right.
No, you know, they work pretty good in conjunction with themselves because I'm able to, you know, a lot of times if I finish a dog for a customer and it is capable of making my string of dogs, I'll do that. And so I'll take the finished dog that one of my clients has, put him on my string of dogs, and over the next period of time, however they want it to be, that dog's going to see more birds than probably it ever will the rest of its life.
Probably the best training of all right there.
Oh, entirely. Entirely. The best training is hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And that said, I mean, we know that wild bird opportunities are limited today. I'm blessed to have a lot of wild bird habitat. Wherever I go, that's kind of the target that we try to pursue. Wild birds, without a doubt, train a dog so much faster and so much better than, you know, what we've got to do commercially with pen raised birds.
Yeah. Now you're up there and you're mainly hunting rough grouse and woodcock on the wild bird side.
Yes, sir.
If you were to offer one bit of advice, we don't want to know exactly where you go, obviously, but if, you know, our listeners are all about the same things. They're looking for places to hunt wild birds all the time. Could you offer up just maybe a tip or two in terms of finding great habitat, whether it's recognizing the stuff that's important when you get there or how to find it somewhere on a map?
Well, most of my rough grouse and woodcock guided trips are in the UP.
Yeah.
While I'm training dogs up there in the summertime, taking advantage of those cool mornings and cool evenings when it stays light until almost 10 o'clock at night, I'm able to work the dogs on grouse and woodcock. And of course, as I find broods, I'm noting them. And when we go back to hunt in the fall, I got a pretty good idea where the birds are at and where they're not. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, grouse and woodcock are going to change areas a little bit as the season goes on, but it helps us target the populations where they're strong. And maybe, for instance, one part of a county might have had a heavy rain in the springtime, which is crucial to hatching chicks. Another part of that county might not have got that rain. So scouting is so important to finding birds, I guess is what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
You know, while many people are boating or going to the beach or golfing, I'm out there working my dogs.
And
I have for 30 years. And but I guess to answer your question directly, how would somebody go about finding that good habitat from home? They can get on the myhunt.com website. That's a mapping service provided by the Michigan DNR, completely free of charge, that will help educate you and put you in the right areas so you're not spinning your wheels looking in bad potential habitat areas.
There are services like that for almost every bird hunting state. And I would imagine for the big game guys too. And boy, I just got an email from a listener and he basically asked that same question. I sent him to the online hunting resources in Kansas that will do the same thing. So,
yeah, you know, it's a great resource. The technology that we have today, as far as mapping, is just incredible. And if you can utilize some of that and educate yourself, you're going to spend a lot less time in unproductive habitat, whether it be grouse and woodcock or pheasants and sharptails across the board, you know. And when you find a bird or two, note where you're finding them at. You know, what's surroundings look like, what's the cover type, what are they feeding on. Certainly the first bird of the day, I always open up the crop, let's see what he's been feeding on.
So
then we're that.
Okay, so by the way, you're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. That's Tracy Liske. He's a professional hunting guide, hunt manager at Mimo's Farm in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. I notice you guys also do hunts on the lower Upper Peninsula. Okay, is that like southern North Dakota or northern South Dakota?
Yeah, Mimo's, we have about 1,700 acres that is in a diverse cover type habitat. Some of it's in a release bird program. We do have wild birds on the properties too. Really a beautiful, beautiful place. And some really unique opportunities to get your dog into some, you know, really good hard flying birds.
Nice. Let's continue on the hunting side of things for a while. We're not going to neglect everybody. We're not going to neglect the dog training side, because I've got a lot of questions about that as well. But while we got some momentum here, one of the things that I've started doing is exactly what you just described, Tracy, and that is opening up the crops, especially on the first birds I shoot, if I hit anything. And it is very educational, but what I haven't figured out is the simplest way to do that. All right, so let's get our fingers a little bit dirty here. When you're going to do that, how are you doing it?
I just take my thumb and forefinger and open up the skin.
Yeah.
You know, and if it's a tougher bird like a seasoned rooster, you might have to take your knife to do it. But, you know, it's imperative that you find out what that bird's feeding upon
What I've been amazed, at least out in the West, how late in the day birds start filling up that crop, how late they actually start eating, which is also eye-opening in a lot of ways. But if you're new to that whole game, everybody, Tracy, point out where on a bird's anatomy we're going to find that crop.
Right at the top of the breast. If you take your thumb and put it right into the cavity at the top of the breast between the left and the right side, that's where you want to enter the skin.
Right. And sometimes there's nothing in there. Other times there's a wad of cheatgrass seeds in that chucker's crop that's as big as a tennis ball. But that's just me. Tracy, professional hunting guide hat on you right now. What is the biggest mistake that your guide clients make in the woods when they're hunting with you?
Well, with rough grouse and woodcock, positioning yourself is so important. You got to anticipate where the exit route is going to be for that bird coming off the ground. Not so much with prairie birds, because you don't have the trees, of course. But with grouse and woodcock, positioning is so important. You know, getting right up to the point, realizing that the bird might not be exactly where the dog's pointing. Grouse and woodcock, as all birds, are running today, and running more than they ever have, I think, just kind of out of a Darwinism evolution. The birds that sat tight were harvested. The birds that ran lived on to breed again. As my good friend Steve Smith from the Point and Dog Journal fame says, quail are running like woodcock, woodcock are running like grouse, grouse are running like pheasants, and pheasants are running like hell.
Leave it to Steve. That is brilliant and so true. So, you know, let's deal with
it. That's for sure.
Let's deal with that, because number one, let's not leave that positioning thing, because wouldn't you think that the positioning also, we're worried about where the bird's going to go, but we're also worried about actually having room to swing our shotgun. I mean, I've shot a lot of alder trees over the years. So that becomes more of a priority for me, because I don't need any more excuses for my bad shooting. But what can we do about these running birds? We got a dog that we think is pretty good, and then we take him out into the woods on a wild rough grouse hunt, and all of a sudden they're all running on us. What should we expect from, and what can we train for with our dog?
Well, first of all, a dog's only going to get better by experience. And the more you can get them on wild birds, the better. I let my dogs reposition themselves if the bird does run out from under them. I like to have a dog that will, to use an old term, set the bird. And I remember an old friend of my father's would ask me if my dog, he was a old grouse hunter back in the 50s and 60s were, and he'd ask me if my dogs were setting the birds, and I says, what? I said, Neil, they're pointing them. he says, your dogs got to learn how to set them. And I finally figured out what he was talking about. That dog's got to be, put the fear in that bird, the bird is going to set tight and wait for the hunters. And some dogs can do that naturally. Other dogs, it takes a little longer. Some of them will never get it at all.
Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Scott.
So how do we tell whether the dog is doing that or the bird is reacting the way we want? I mean, is there's no telltale sign, is there?
Well, if your dog goes on point and you go into flush and there's nothing there and you can see the dog let down in intensity, Sorry, that bird has moved on. It probably wasn't flushed. You didn't hear it. So you release the dog and let him or her pursue the bird again. and hopefully you get another point. But with enough repetition, that dog will learn that not to stand there like a statue when there's nothing there. And I know in the field trial game, that's not what we want. In the hunting world, though, where we're shooting birds, we certainly want a dog to have productive points. Now, my clients don't want to walk into 30 unproductive points. After a while, they would kind of turn their head when the dog goes on point because he's figured nothing there anyways.
Yeah.
When my dogs go on point, I want there to be a bird there.
So we're giving them a little bit of leeway in terms of selection and decision making.
Exactly. You know, an old mentor of mine back in Michigan told me that years ago he told me a pointing dog should be 90% out of control, 10% under control.
Yeah, I got a wire hair that's about right in that ratio.
And then a flushing dog or a retriever uses a flushing dog needs to be 90% under control and 10% out of control. So they're just complete opposites.
I love that idea, and we'll talk more about the balance there later on in the Upland Nation podcast. That's Tracy Liske. He's with MimosFarm.com in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Hunt manager, dog trainer extraordinaire, been in the game for a long time. Scott Linden here, your host, still learning my way through the podcast world, but I hope you're enjoying and learning from it. Tracy, if you had to narrow it down to the minimal number of commands and skills that we need to teach a good hunting dog, could you do that?
Well, first of all, most people talk to the dogs way too much. Not only does that confuse the dog, but going back to our wild bird scenario, that's alerting every bird in the county where you're at. So I don't talk to my dogs at all. All my communication with the dog is through the collar.
Now I'm intrigued. Tell me how you use that collar.
Well, you know, the collars today are equipped with a variable intensity dial. Or buttons, or whichever brand you're using, it doesn't matter. To turn the dog, if the dog's on the far left and I want him to go to the right and quarter in front of me, we train him to turn on two nicks, a tap on the momentary button of the transmitter. And for them to come all the way in to you, we use four taps on the momentary button on the collar. I don't use a whistle. The only time I use a whistle is if a dog's having a hard time finding me, which, you know, in the grouse woods, we early season, you can't see 10 yards ahead of you. Sometimes that comes into play. But most of the time, I do not want to be talking at all.
You know, I tell you, Tracy, every year I relearn this same lesson over and over again, and I'm evolving to the same point you are. I'm using the collar in various ways. I'm using that beeper and that vibrate function a lot more than I thought I would, doing the same things you are, but with those instead. How about the hunters themselves? What are the things that you find yourself always trying to remind your hunting clients about when they're in the field, besides getting in the right position for a shot? Safety, skills, well, strategy, whatever.
Yes, I mean, safety is always paramount. You know, this is for sport. We're not doing it to put food on the table. And, you know, safety is always, you know, the number one concern. That said, most of my clients are repeat customers, so they get it. They've hunted with me before, so we don't have to spend a lot of time talking about it. But I start every hunt with a safety briefing. You know, tell them not to take low birds, keep their gun muzzle pointed in a safe direction. You know, we all understand basic firearm safety. But concerning what the hunters, what I would like them to do more, get yourself in shape. If you golf, don't take a cart. If you shoot sporting clays, leave them carts back at the clubhouse. Get your legs in shape so you can walk. It's been said by people smarter than me that birds aren't killed by shotguns, they're killed by legs, being able to cover a lot of ground.
That will be a part of our discussion in the second half of the show, by the way, so stick around for that. I got a question coming up from one of our listeners on that. If you were going to tell somebody how to be a better shooter in the field in one fell swoop, what is the one thing I could do differently that would help me hit more birds?
I would say probably the number one thing, if you're going to shoot clay targets of any discipline, shoot with a low gun.
Mm-hmm.
The gun mount's so paramount in getting on target, and you know, that builds muscle memory so that you're quicker in the field. And that's probably the best thing that somebody could do is away from, you know, taking an actual shooting lesson from a qualified shooting instructor.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned quickness, and I'm working on exactly the opposite, because eventually it will pay off in a quicker, a better mount, but you got to start slow. You don't start by, you don't run the 100-meter hurdles at full-on speed the first time you're going over hurdles. You got to learn how to get over the hurdles first. And I'm back to that. I'm going back to school on that whole idea. But the low gun mount is absolutely critical, and I couldn't agree more with that. When you're in the field with your dogs, and you've got a big string, so it's a little bit different for you, but if you need to run a dog or all your dogs, and you need to keep up their energy levels, there's conditioning, of course, and you're probably doing some of that. But then in the field that day, for example, do you feed the morning of a hunt when you're going to run that dog?
No, I do not. Mm-hmm. I feed at 5 o'clock at night every night.
And all season then?
All season.
Okay. So your dog doesn't have to worry about that in the morning. What if they start lagging during the day? Is there anything you can do? Some people will call it low blood sugar. Other people will call it other things. But there are dogs that will they just can't cut it after 2-3 hours in the field. Can you give them anything, or do you do anything to prevent that?
Well, you know, I can understand that from, you know, a hunter having just one or two dogs, mm-hmm. you know, and having mm-hmm. to, you know, got a trip planned with me or out west or wherever, and you got 3 days to hunt, and your dog's out of gas. That's a pretty difficult situation because you still want a bird hunt. I know that there's lots of commercial supplements on the market. I think you're best off starting with just a good quality 30-20 dog food and conditioning your dog.
How are you doing that with your dogs? Is it mainly that the summertime, I'll call it scouting/training, or do you rode your dogs as well?
I rode them as well.
And how are you doing that?
I do it off a four-wheeler.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
An ATV that, you know, I've got, it's set up so I can run four dogs at a time. And not only does it build their conditioning, it also toughens their feet so you don't have problems with their feet out in the field.
Yeah.
Again, it's just, I know that a lot of the hunters out there have got to have other things that they do in their life, you know, whether it's work or whether it's going to the kids' Little League baseball game. But spending time with your dog, getting him in shape, getting yourself in shape, scouting preseason so you know where you're going to go on opening day. That's what makes a quality, successful hunt.
Well, this guy knows what he's talking about. That's Tracy Liske. I'm Scott Linden. This is the Upland Nation podcast. Tracy, hang on. You get a quick break while I start selling stuff around here. So everybody else stick around. We also have a question from one of our listeners on a related subject. So we'll be back with our Handle It segment in just a moment. First, though, speaking of conditioning and all things related, Dr. Tim's Performance dog food is the stuff I've been using for a long time for good reasons. Tracy mentioned the 30-20 ratio. That may be enough for some dogs, but out here in the West, a dog that's running as much as mine, he's going to get about a 32 to 36% protein and a lot higher fat than that 20. Dr. Tim has one for every type of dog doing every type of exercise. So take a look at drtims.com. One of the things I like about Tim is, number one, he's a veterinarian and a sled dog racer, and his food has won the Iditarod for dogs multiple times. But the amino acids that are critical to a dog's muscles, bones, and brain power all come from different sources, different types of ingredients. And Tim has made a study of all of that and designed each formulation to meet the needs of a dog that is expected to function at peak performance. Of course, they'll deliver it right to your door, just like everybody else. But these guys support the hunting community, unlike some of those others. 30% off your first order. Use the code UPLANDNATION at drtims.com, Dr. Tim's. Boy, the questions I get, and I sure love them. This Handle It segment seems to be getting more and more questions these days, and to keep them coming, I'm happy to try and address your issues there. It's all brought to you by Happy Jack Dog Care Remedies, skin coat, parasites, fleas, and ticks. It's all available at happyjackinc.com, including some great solutions to your dog's pad problems. This is related in a way to what we've been talking about so far. Don Schur has asked me in recent days, when on a long pheasant hunt, what is a good rule of thumb on pacing your dog in the field for time? And so, Don, I've addressed this in a couple different ways because I'm not quite sure exactly what you mean by time, but out here in the West, if we're hunting chuckers, our dogs are going to cover 10 to 30, sometimes 35 miles in a day. But that's big open country, and that's the way you got to find those birds. You know, a pheasant dog like you're talking about, if you're in the right place at the right time, a dog could hunt 2 miles and put your limit in your bag. It could be 5 miles to do all that. Probably on level ground, which is good. If your dog is running more than 5 or 6 miles a day for a pheasant hunt, then your dog is working pretty darn hard, especially if there's crops that haven't been cut, even a cut cornfield for that matter. That's hard work. And then if you want to know about how many hours, well, that depends as well. You know, you have all heard about pheasant hunts that conclude in 15 minutes. Because so many birds got up in front of the hunters that day, but 2 to 7 hours is probably a, you know, fair estimation of what you can expect a dog to do in any given day on any given type of bird. And if your dog is working that hard at the long end of some of those days, you probably ought to think seriously about giving that dog at least a full day to rest afterwards. I know it's easier said than done. Doesn't happen all the time, that's for sure. But if you can, give him a break. Tracy Liske, would you concur with those bits of advice for what they're worth?
Oh, without a doubt. That's all spot on. Something else I could add to the hunter that might be running out of dog power. during a 2 or 3 day hunt. You might look at getting a buddy that's got a dog, or better yet, adding to your kennel of dogs and getting another one. I try to buy a dog or obtain a dog every 3 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Minimum. And even if, you know, you're an individual hunter that's doing it for a pastime and a hobby and not a profession, if you had a dog, dogs that were 9, 6, and 3, you got 3 dogs, you should be able to just about cover anything with proper rotation and proper conditioning of those 3 dogs.
You know, that is absolutely correct. I couldn't agree more. And of course, the reason Flick is in the kennel here is because back in the day, Manny broke a toe. And all of a sudden, that changed the dynamic at the house enough to give me permission to get another wire hair, which I'm knocking wood for. So injuries, as well as that fatigue factor. And then there is the joy of hunting with somebody else's dog once in a while. I know it's tough. And my buddy Dave would say he will never hunt unless he can hunt with his own dog. And I understand all of that. But all good reasons to consider adding another dog to your string. What are the biggest challenges to a string as big as yours, Tracy?
Well, I only have 7 dogs currently, Scott.
Yeah.
I've got them in range of ages from 13 to 2. And, you know, having 7 dogs is certainly more than most individual hunters are going to get into. But as far as keeping those dogs conditioned, it's a lot of work. But it pays dividends in the hunting season.
Well, we've explained all of that, and I get it. I absolutely get it. Are there practical considerations for somebody who has more than one dog that maybe you've learned times 7 that you could pass along to us?
Well, traveling's always difficult, you know,
yeah.
When you've got dogs, you know, as far as the actual travel to get to your destination. And then, you know, once you get there, taking care of them when you're not in the field. So that consumes a big part of my day. Making sure that my dogs are well taken care of, whether they're my personal dogs or dogs that I'm training.
Are there any things that you do when you're on the road with that many dogs or several dogs? Maybe you don't take them all the time, but you do move them around, I'm sure. In terms of where you stop, what you do when you stop, how frequently you stop when you're on the road, anything like that that we might not think about that has come in handy for you?
Well, a lot of our training, so to speak, dogs have to be trained to travel.
Yeah.
They have to experience it. For a dog that's never been in a dog trailer or in a dog box or a travel crate for multiple hours at a time, you know, that trip to South Dakota or the west end of the UP could be a little difficult for them to do that. So we like to, you know, spend time traveling the back roads with our dogs in the crates and get them used to bouncing around, get them used to what that whole lifestyle is like traveling and not being in the kennel all the time.
Do you know, it's funny. I was just thinking about this because I have a friend up in upstate New York who's got the ultimate traveling rig for a dog guy. And I never thought about this because I do. I spoil my dogs. They always have bedding in their travel crates as well. When you're traveling, do you have anything in there that helps them along those lines, whether it's hay or a bedding of some sort?
Very seldom.
Yeah.
Do I like to put anything in a travel crate or in a trailer box as far as bedding or... You know, it seems like they just cause more problem than it solves.
Yeah, yeah, especially if you have to clean up.
Yeah, you know, we've got cold weather concerns in Michigan, as well as, you know, some warm weather concerns, too. And when I travel to the south in the wintertime, a lot of times it can get warm. So with the bedding, it just seems to be, it sounds good and it sounds necessary to us, you know, but I don't think it's necessary for a dog.
Yeah. Whether you're traveling or you're training, wherever we are in our backyard, and I'll be out shooting a video later today using some of this stuff, but what are some of the more critical bits of training equipment that you use that we probably ought to invest in as well?
I try to keep it really simple, Scott. Again, a lot of my training's on wild birds.
Yeah.
So it eliminates the need for seeking out hard-flying pen-raised birds. We like to use pigeons in the off-season when the moratorium is on for running bird dogs on the wild birds, you know, due to nesting.
Yeah.
Probably the biggest problem that I have to overcome when a dog comes in for training is the fact that its owners had it out on pen-raised birds that wouldn't fly and the dogs caught them.
Very common. We see it every training day around here as well. So how do you get over that?
Well, you know, there's certainly a lot of brands of launchers on the market. They help. You know, if all you have to train with is pen-raised birds.
I've become a big believer in those. If you're careful and you are watching your dog carefully, you can simulate a wild bird behavior.
Yeah, and it's good to set up a situation that maybe you're trying to rectify that the dog may have a problem with.
Mm-hmm.
So no, the launchers help immensely, and I like to use pigeons because a dog's not going to catch a pigeon coming out of a launcher, whereas a pen-raised quail, you know, they might fly, even coming out of the launcher, they might only fly 30 or 40 yards.
Yeah, and a motivated dog will run 130, 40 yards if he wants it bad enough.
Entirely.
What about check cords, steadiness? What's your expectation for steadiness in the field when you're hunting with clients, for example?
Well, first of all, I don't teach woe. I don't use that word in my vocabulary whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Why
is that?
What I find with Scott, with owners of dogs that I've trained or maybe I'm hunting with them, and years ago when I did teach woe, what do we do is we're walking that dog into a place where we know we put a bird. Chances are first thing you're going to say before the dog even thinks about it, you're going to say woe. And woe the bird, woe the dog into the bird.
Yeah.
We teach the dog, woe means when the bird's flushing. They don't want to flush the bird. And a bird in the air means that they better stop.
Mm-hmm. So the bird becomes the teacher and the bird becomes the command, the flying
exactly.
Bird. Yeah.
We know dog training is all associated behavior for the most part. We can stop the dog on woe, certainly, if that's how it was trained, because they associate the word woe with stopping. Well, I go the other direction, and a bird in the air means to stop. So consequently, we get some pretty hard points, a lot more intensity. We keep the prey drive up. We're not talking to the dog again and alerting all the wild birds in the area where we're at. And the dog is much more confident doing his task of hunting because he doesn't feel like he's being overhandled.
Do you expect him to be steady through the the flush and the shot and the fall, or where do you draw the line on that debate?
Well, that's certainly a can of worms. And it depends on what you're looking for. Now, a finished dog to some people is a dog that points birds. Mm-hmm. Finished to me means that you're happy with where it's at. My personal dogs are never finished. I'm training them all the time.
My personal dogs are never finished either, and it's all my fault.
Well, and that happens, sure. And, you know, with a long hunting season or a long preserve season, we can let some things go that all of a sudden become big problems along the way. I like a dog to be steady to wing shot and fall. However, for the average hunter who's carrying a shotgun and trying to handle the dog and trying to shoot the bird that the dog points in the flush, it's not real realistic that you can pay attention to that dog all the time. When I'm guiding, I'm not carrying a shotgun. I've got a transmitter in my hand, and I'm watching the dog. And I very seldom watching the bird. I'm watching that dog.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So it makes it a lot easier to maintain that steady to wing shot and fall.
Yeah. So along those lines, in the field or in our training, what is something we should never do to our dog?
Well, there's a lot of things, I think, Scott. I think overhandling is probably the biggest concern.
So follow the hunter with a long nose.
Let the dog do what he was bred to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mentioned some of the trainers that I've worked with over the years. One of the first mentors that I had was a gentleman that's a place called Hunter's Creek Club, a private operation, hunting operation in Michigan. And he started it in 1948. He was paramount in getting the extended seasons for the preserved bird hunting.
Mm-hmm.
Through you know, Michigan state government as well as on the national level. His name was Preston Mann Sr. And Preston called me into his office one day and said, "Tracy, I got a little bit of training advice for you." And I thought, well, hell, I'm going to go outside and get a notebook and take notes on this. And so I went and come back inside and sat down across from his desk, and the first thing he did is he slid open the top drawer of the desk, grabbed a roll of duct tape, pulled off about a 6-inch piece and ripped it off, walked around and put it across my mouth.
Yep. Yep.
He says, "Tracy, talking too much." He says, "You confuse the dog." You know, it's just like a kid that, you know, you're constantly talking to and threatening that you're going to do this, or you're going to do that, you're going to be grounded, but it never happens. The same thing with the dogs. You know, we start by saying, you know, whatever your callback command is, whether it's their name or here or come, and that starts off in a softer tone. And if the dog's not complying, all of a sudden now it's very elevated, or in fact shouting, and it's confusing the dog.
I agree, and I think I met him once. Long story short, I'll tell you that one some other time. But I think I was there for one day, and I think I met him while I was there. That was a while back. But what about the opposite? What should we always do to our dogs, for our dogs, when we're hunting or training? What is the one universal that dogs can't get enough of that's going to help them in some way?
Be consistent in whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
Be consistent. Dogs, again, learn from associated behavior. They thrive on consistency. a dog that anticipates something to happen is a dog that's going to be looking for trouble or going to get into trouble.
Sounds like the kids I used to teach.
Entirely. There's so many parallel ideas about kids and dogs and how we take care of them, and how we train them, how we educate them. I think that the best thing that we can do with our dogs is, number one, give them a foundation, show them what we want. From there, take them to the field and let Mother Nature teach them. Let those genetics come out. Dogs are born knowing more about bird hunting than most of us ever will. A well-bred dog, I should say. So let that dog do its thing. Be consistent in your commands, however you choose to reinforce that. Be consistent, and the dog will be happier. You'll have a better trained dog, and the biggest benefit, you're going to have more birds in the bag.
Well, amen to that, and that sounds like a good place to conclude this part of the Upland Nation podcast. Tracy Liske, people can learn more about you and what you're doing and what they're doing over there at mimosfarm.com. That's MEEMOSFARM.com. MEEMOSFARM.com. Tracy Liske, learned a lot from you. Thank you so much for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast.
You're welcome, Scott. Again, thank you for the invitation.
And you're welcome too. And you're welcome, listeners, to stick around. Scott Linden here. First thing we're going to do is take a look at the Upland Nation Insights e-newsletter. Every week I'm asking you a question of one sort or another. Most recently I asked if you're a member of any upland conservation group. And good on you, 70% of you said yes. The only question is, what about the rest of you? See no value in that? Or is it just that you haven't found the group for you yet? I mean, whether it's a local group, national group, it doesn't matter. There's somebody out there for you. Maybe it starts with a dog training club and it goes from there. Most of the dog training clubs I'm familiar with are doing a lot of work in the world of conservation as well. So consider that, please. It's the easiest way to support all the things that are important to us. And finally, this land is your land. And it is. So much out there in the way of wild bird habitat, whether you're supporting it or not, it's worth it to explore a little bit and learn more. And that's why we do this segment every week. It's brought to you by the UplandNationDeals.com website. Sometimes new stuff, but always lightly used brand name pro level gear at about entry level prices. And by the way, if you're looking to unload one of your unused e-collars or GPS collars, they are moving really fast, selling in a day or two. So let us help you do that as well. It's all at UplandNationDeals.com. Okay, usually I'm talking about a place for you to go hunting that's publicly accessible and might hold some birds. But this time I'm going to talk a little bit more about the gestalt, the whole idea of hunting in communities around the country. Hunting is economic development. Sightseers aren't probably the tourists supporting an economy in those towns that we visit for hunting. In fact, in many of those towns, the only thing they got going for them in the way of visitors is visiting hunters. They are what propels the local hardware store, restaurant, hotel, all of the above. So if you want to see the welcome mat rolled out in upcoming seasons, Consider doing your part by buying your fuel, your groceries, your ammo in the town nearest the destination. I know you can't always do it, and you do need to plan ahead, and sometimes there is no community, but when there is, some of the benefits include keeping those businesses in business for next year, and supporting them will ultimately support the hunting economy. Stay at a local hotel, eat at the coffee shop, hire a local guide periodically, visit the historic sites, go to the local high school football game, always a good time somewhere in that community, depending on which community it is, and always stop at the local chamber of commerce. They'll have up-to-date information and maybe a hunting tip or two. A lot of them keep a list of the places that are available for hunters like you and me. Thank you for listening. Appreciate your allowing me to extrapolate a little bit on my economic development philosophy. And that is enough of a lecture from me. I hope you learned something from Tracy Leeske here at the Upland Nation podcast. I sure did. If you enjoyed the podcast, please rate us at Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends. Check in every day at the Wing Shooting USA and the Upland Nation Facebook pages. Appreciate your doing all of that, and all of those of you who do rate us, thank you a little bit more, including Rick Ray. And by the way, welcome to the world of podcasts, Rick. Our quote this week, anonymous. Boy, does he or she have a lot of great things to say, including this. If you can look at a dog and not feel vicarious excitement and affection, you must be a cat. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Scott Linden. This is the Upland Nation Podcast. Talk to you soon.